What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. No don't more. Hurt me.
No more.
You can hurt me a little bit.
Bow, 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 bow. Sorry.
Welcome to Threat Detection. We do that every week. You've never heard it before because we usually cut it out. But we thought this week we would give you the full shilling, the 8 inches.
Everything. You're going to hear everything this week that we've always wanted to say, including me banging this chair in anxiety.
All
You'll
the touches.
Everything.
All this of the, is a the looks.
Filler episode. It's filler. This is the ice cream between the wafers. This is the peanut butter with the Nutella. This is the prostitute between marriages or even in the marriage. This is it. This is filler. It's everything we wanted to do because we hadn't gotten enough time to research a lot of other things and specificity because we've been away.
We are too important to waste our time preparing for this show. And you are going to suffer or enjoy the consequences in this, our filler episode, composed almost entirely of ideas that weren't good enough for a regular episode.
This is the worst of Threat Detection, but with the best of all together in one kind of hour-long episode, or potentially 2 hours, although I hope an hour, because, you know,
you do have to get home.
Yes, yeah, we all have to get home at some stage, Gareth.
What's been keeping you busy, James? We've been gone for a long time. What is it, a month since we did an episode?
No, it's been 2 weeks. It's been 2 weeks. I kept track.
Feels like a month.
Yeah, it might as well have been a month or years in years. The emotional journey we've had.
Do you know, you're not wrong. You know, yeah. I've become a man. You've become a slightly bigger boy.
I have my own cap.
Your short trousers are now down to your knee instead of just
cap,
a crotch.
A penis cap and a cap for my head. All the caps. Apologies.
How's your dental dam doing?
I actually have a chipped tooth.
I noticed. I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, well, no, it's very noticeable.
I was referring to the vaginal dental dam used.
Oh, it's much better. Thank you very much. Okay. Yeah.
What happened to your tooth? Was it a wolf?
No, that was not a wolf, sadly. Although I'm sure if it was a wolf, you'd see more of a mark.
James was visiting with the wolves, like Jack Nicholson in the film Wolf. Wolf.
Yeah. And much like Jack Nicholson, I got bitten in a sense, but didn't really get bitten because I didn't actually get to encounter the wolves in a way I could pet them. It wasn't that kind of wolf tour. Just to bring this up, I went to London for about a week with my girlfriend, and we went to a wolf sanctuary in Berkshire.
Ooh, Berkshire.
Well, I say Berkshire, it's more Reading.
I say girlfriend, it's more bloke.
Yeah. Well, today, these terms, what do they mean anymore, Gareth? You know, gender ambiguity, that's kind of what I'm in support of, because it defends the fact that I have problems with my girlfriend.
You don't know what's going on in my chest. So much ambiguity.
I saw wolves. They were beautiful creatures. There was about 7 of them being fed by trainers in this fantastic sanctuary called the Wolf Trust.
Cruelly, they were only being fed trainers.
No, they were being... Wait, okay.
Wait.
I love that I defended that. That's incorrect.
No, they were given meat.
Jesus, literal Jim over here.
Literalism is the finest form of cheap humour.
I have a cap because as a child, Gareth, when I was about 7 years old, I fell off of a wall about 10 feet high and chipped both my front teeth, which are not real. And they were replaced... Yes, it's a tiny... That's not quite a violin, Gareth. That's not even a cello. I don't know what that is.
It was a tiny
that's
accordion.
Modern synth. It's like
it was a tiny Stockhausen and I was squeezing him.
It's more like a mouse you're kind of slowly strangling. So I'd chip both teeth. They're not real. So I had them replaced by fillings. And one
Wait,
of the fillings,
are all your teeth false?
Just the front. Like the rest of my life.
Your whole
false.
Head is just full of gums.
This is all false right here. So the two teeth came out. I replaced them with fillings. And then one of them chipped again. Because that's what happens after a while. They start to lose their constitution. So that's kind of what's happened.
That's really creepy.
Is it?
I'm just trying to figure out what other parts of you aren't real.
Huh?
Do you have like one glass eye?
No, that'd be really cool.
Do you have an innie penis?
A what penis?
An innie.
You know, can you please explain this to your... I mean, because I know you think the audience is people you already know who will just immediately get a concept, but pretend we have a real audience.
Well,
you
with
don't
a,
know.
With a belly button, you got an outie and an innie. And
yeah. Okay, do I have an innie belly button? No, I don't know. I'm gaining weight. It could be an outie at this point, so it's hard.
Okay, so just for anyone at home, James is a man with anorexia. This is a rare thing, but he believes himself to be obese.
No, because look, we'll get into this complex another time, because I actually would spend hours defending it. That's how bad this stuff is. We have, in a way, I've been in London doing a number of different things. I went to the Globe, saw Julius Caesar. Incredible.
The actual Julius Caesar?
Yes, he was there. They brought him out. He's looking pretty bad.
They must have plastinated him after
died. I have to say, the Globe is as fantastic as people say it is. It is expensive.
I thought it was in Stratford-on-Avon.
The Globe?
Yeah.
Why is he saying that like it's a bad thing? I don't understand what your point is.
Okay, so is Stratford-on-Avon in London?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Sorry, everybody. Didn't know.
It was actually on the Queen's Walk, so I'm not quite sure if that's Stratford-on-Avon. So the Queen's Walk, built in 1977, everyone knows it. It's the embankment where you can see the London Eye and you can see the Houses of Parliament, and then just down to the left is the Globe. So it was wonderful. It was a it was actually an amazing theater, and I would highly advise anyone to go there for the £15 price. It was. They were very dedicated to recreating that entire time and getting the audience to become the actual audience of the play itself.
Oh, really? So, it was done in the
Shakespearean
shout
Julius
fashion.
Caesar. We shout his name. We also shout for Brutus towards the end.
Did they have a warm up guy to tell you all this stuff?
No.
Oh, Julius is going to come out. And you're going to give him a big round of applause, okay? Everybody, he's had a hard day. He's going to get cancelled.
Okay, so when it says applause. Yeah,
yeah. Well, when I say boo, you say shaka. Boo, shaka. Boo, shaka.
Yeah, because of course Public Enemy also showed up. Not missing a moment for publicity. It was a great theatre production. It was about an hour and 10 minutes, and it was wonderful. So you yourself, though, were also away. This time, where did you were in...
I was away somewhere so pretentious, I actually feel embarrassed to admit.
Oh, you're on the line now, Gareth.
I was sent away to cover a Beckett festival in the town Beckett went to school in, which is Enniskillen in County Fermanagh in Northern Ireland. It was pretty pretentious. I went to see Beckett in Yiddish. I was sent down into a cave system called the Marble Arch to see a piece by John Cage, he of 433, the silent famous piece.
Yeah.
But this was a piece called Roratorio, which is based on Finnegan's Wake. What else did I say?
It's a fantastic story, though. It's one of my favorites.
I don't know anything about Beckett or about Joyce. Yeah. Nothing. Mm. I was totally the wrong person for it. But what else? Oh, yeah, Gavin Bryars, this composer who wrote that amazing Jesus Blood Never Failed Me Yet, which he almost never performs. He performed it with a full, you know, 10-piece, I don't know what that's called. It's not an orchestra, it's like an orchestrette.
This is my fault because I led you into this, but I think rolling out the red carpet for that level of pretentious art, and these are video game people supposed to listen to this. I was a video gamer devout once upon a time.
Well, Beckett was actually a huge gamer.
Yeah, he loved Atari games.
He did. Like, that was all they had back in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah,
when he was
absolutely.
When he was living in Paris during World War II working for the resistance, he actually got the world high score in Pong.
Yeah. It's the perfect time to get it.
Yeah. And actually, a lot of his games are based on those early Atari, the simplicity.
Even though he liked Atari, he became so ashamed of the company's direction that he actually bought Intellivision as well. It's a little known thing about him.
He did. Of course, they were made of wood back then.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. And Don Draper actually did the advert that convinced him to buy.
The guy that Don Draper's based on, yeah, made the ads.
No, actual Don Draper.
Oh, okay, yeah. You have to cut down trees back then as well to make your own consoles, of course. Oak. So this is kind of. These are the days, guys.
Some consolation.
Classic gaming. Although we will make this, we'll do this fake history retro stuff.
That would have been a much better episode.
We would do it. We should do that sometime. Do a
fake history of video games.
Yeah, definitely. But going back into now, we've had 2 weeks off from this show, so we're back. It's filler. We have a lot of concepts on the table, or in this case, on our laps. So let's start with the first one. What's our first one here?
Ooh, gaming magazines and media of yore.
Yes.
What a perfect transition from that history of Beckett on Nintendo or Atari. Blah blah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So my gaming magazine probably was PC. It was a mixture of PC Gamer and another unofficial PlayStation magazine called PSM2, where they would always name their writers and editors like Danny D and KGG. They would always have like this terrible pun and play on words because God forbid someone has a full second name. They would just kind of went with a quick quixotic use of nicknames, and they were very British. And these are the kinds of people who were like from Leeds or someplace like that. And they would put out discs with every magazine to try and get more, obviously, because, you know...
Floppy disk?
This is 2002. Yes, of course. It's 2002, 2004, before you could have, like, dominant YouTube, you know, vodcasters.
Oh, so there were CDs already at that point.
Well, there was CDs and DVDs, and their whole thing was to try and get, obviously, to get your circulation way up by promoting the shit out of new previews that only you had access to. But they were the first guys who actually demonstrated for me the modern day quick look or let's plays. Because their previews of games, and this is no joke, this is not a recapitulation. It would cut, if you put on the DVD into your PlayStation 2 or whatever DVD player you had, it would cut really quickly to like say, okay, here's a preview for Neverwinter Nights. And you'd hit that preview and it would just go into these two thick Leeds accent people saying things like, oh yeah, so it's Neverwinter. It's like Neverwinter 1, and it's the Dungeons and Dragons. Is it Dungeons and Dragons? Yeah, it's Dungeons and Dragons. Bit shit, though. That's what they would do. That was it. And some of them would be 2 minutes or 1 minute. So it was so let's play. Like, you could hear the Pop-Tarts snapping from when they were going to eat their food and like just go about their day. And the only time they ever got professional was for the PlayStation 3, because they were like the first British magazine to get an exclusive look in a PS3. which they brought into the office, and they were just so chuffed over.
You are so much younger than me.
Yeah,
the PS3 is like, wasn't that like a year or two ago?
I was old enough at this point. Like, when I first started reading PSM2, it was just when the PS2 came out.
Okay.
So, and that was, and the whole thing with my crew of younger gentlemen at the age of 13 and 14 was, you don't read official PlayStation magazines because they're all lies. It's like reading a Libertas publication. It's like reading Daily Mail. You want to read The Guardian. So would you get the unofficial word on the whole thing. So you'd take to either unofficial OPSM2 or you'd get PSM2, which was my magazine. Now, the other magazine I read, which is far superior, and people should remember the editor of this magazine when it first started in Britain in 1993. It's PC Gamer, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic supplementary and article-based and sometimes op-ed-based magazine. PC Gamer, people like Gary Whitta, who now writes for the Walking Dead series and writes for a number of other video games like Prey, or did write for Prey, and he writes for some of the Epic Games stuff. He's now like primarily a freelance writer and for video games. But he started this idea of taking away from like preview dependence.
You can ignore the notes.
I'm just looking at Gareth's notes, which are highly, because the worst part is your cursor comes up in pink.
Sorry.
And pink is such a loud color.
We had like what 20 minutes to prepare for this.
Yeah.
So I'm actively I'm like one line ahead. I'm writing James's script speaking.
Don't make excuses. This is a fantastic form of art. What we're doing is we're giving like
improvisational, improvised through the feedback criticism.
Exactly, as we develop it. You know, much like you recently talked about the old BBC broadcasts of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Just doing it in that night.
Douglas Adams with a coffee 10 minutes before air.
Absolutely. This is the way we're doing it. But Gary Whitta, and you should remember that my time was not with Gary Whitta, because that's 1993. My time was with people like Matt Pierce and publishers who moved into PC Gamer when I went to America. And the idea of it was, previews and boost a lot of reviews, but really the focus is all on constant experience. So it's experiential, first-person, one-to-one accounts of the games. Now, a lot of magazines had variations of that at the end, but for the most part, it was all boosting previews, promotion, and selling. PC Gamer quickly steered away from that and got a much wider subscription, probably becoming the best circulation of a video game magazine worldwide. And the British version of it was always the definitive for me. You could get the American one in Ireland for a little while. They used to publish versions of it over here because it was huge in North America. So what you get was, you get features like long plays, you get sit-down reviews, you get things like revisits. And these features, they wouldn't be at the back. They would tend to be in the middle. You would have people take a game like, I don't know, Moonbase Commander, a really odd game that didn't get enough time. And they would go through in like three different pages why it was brilliant. What were the mechanics like? Why did turn-based matter in a game mechanic then? Why did I enjoy it? And they would actually end up reinvigorating through their passion, your passion for maybe going to play that game or something like it. Armed Assault. Game that came out from Bohemia Interactive, which is a Czech. It was a Czech company, a Czech team based on, well, no, it was part Czech, part Ukraine development guys. They were brothers at the time, and they made Operation Flashpoint, which you remember. When they made Armed Assault, it was meant to kind of recreate the Czech Civil War as they saw it, or at least the Yugoslavian one, and kind of look at what it was like to be in these, you know, Russian technology countries of complete dissident, broken apart cycles of people. And it was really more of a military simulator as well, built on top of that. Now, Armed Assault got terrible reviews. It was completely panned. I remember GameSpot gave it a 5.0. No one wanted to get it. Now, PC Gamer did this really odd thing. They gave it a terrible review and yet convinced me to buy it, because in talking about how much fun they had with it, like going down into these missions where you'd have to go under a bridge and blow it up to destroy to stop a convoy from driving over it in an open world way, where you would do it on your own time frame, you would do it under your own auspices, you would find ways of manipulating the environment to blow up the bridge that wouldn't just be using C4. That convinced me to buy it with my friend Tim. We both bought it based on that review, even though I was saying, look, this game's got lots of technical hitches, but its ambition and the enjoyment you get out of these very specific atmospheric scenarios of almost being killed from like, you know, a breath's hair away from being shot, sells it. And that actually made me buy it.
Isn't it funny how companies like that lay down the prototype for how they're going to always work? I mean, they've never gotten beyond that thing of, with the Arma games even today, they launch buggy. They never get fixed. You know, the Flashpoint games too, they Flashpoint buggy as hell when it came out. I don't think it could even be finished initially. And It's interesting that that's a mainstay of the corporate culture they've developed.
That was actually interesting enough. Another PC Gamer article, which I've seen again come up as a topic for Rock, Paper, Shotgun, which is, are willingness to allow games to be released completely bug-filled, especially now in the age of constant online activity where everybody's hooked up to a router or wirelessly access through their consoles, will allow broken games to come out and give them forgiveness. We won't give the forgiveness to the low mid-tier games or sometimes even to indie games. We'll give them forgiveness if they have a lot of hype behind them or if they're AAA, even though sometimes they're outright broken. Like Battlefield 4 was
shoddy. I think that's really not true at all because, it, of course, they come out broken, but they're so much less broken than they were.
Do you think so?
Yes, I know so.
I don't know so because I was there for a lot of games that were, you know, very functional on the release.
It was a regular thing that a game would come out as late as the late 90s, which couldn't be finished. It had a hard crash bug and you could not get online patches because there wasn't a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally you'd get patches on like the cover disc of a games magazine or something like that. But for a lot of games, the bugs just never ever got fixed, and they were so heinous that they would erase saves and things like this.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the sound simply wouldn't work on your rig, or it was a 3D game and you just couldn't run it, and that doesn't happen anymore.
I think this division comes about in our remembrance of our history because I was entirely console based up until much later. Later into my teenage years, console games kind of had to finish with a finesse to them because they were quality tested non-stop before they put out the system, because back then Sony and Nintendo
and they had
gave
the Nintendo
a shit.
Seal of approval,
their golden seal.
Which meant something, it really did. It meant something.
Which always does look like a weird explosion with Nintendo seal on it.
You couldn't have a dirty game too.
Yeah, it did. I mean, that all went away, of course, very quickly. But Sony,
and now Mario's naked in every game.
Yeah, absolutely. Even games that aren't about Mario have naked Marios in them.
Hello!
Is that what he sounds like? It's more of a Yoshi.
Well, I don't know what he sounds like, but he looks like Ron Jeremy. An older, greasier Ron Jeremy.
Does. The guy who voices Mario again? He's a very famous voice actor. He was in...
Ron Jeremy!
No, he was in Adventure Time and things like that.
Oh, is he? Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh.
Ooh.
You have an adventure with Ron Jeremy.
Messing around with the child voice actors, wasn't it?
Well, for my magazines of choice growing up, I suppose Sega Power, Nintendo Power, and CNVG. CNVG was the one I really liked. CNVG was basically, it was called Computer and Video Games. It was basically the British version of EGM. I mean, I don't think their companies had anything to do with each other, but very similar, irreverent tone, often quite clever. I think... could be completely wrong about this, but I think some of the writers later went on to write for Edge. I think that kind of milieu of people, and I don't remember very much about it because it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
You've got this incredibly like vivid memories of all these gaming publications, and I don't think I've read a gaming magazine. Well, that's not true. I read Edge all the time, but only in shops.
Yeah,
I haven't bought a gaming magazine for
a
long time.
I finally bought an edition of Edge. The last time I bought an Edge was January of desperation. Just to have something to distract me that I felt
so expensive now. What is it, like 20,000 euro?
It's the same scope.
It's the same price as a book. Yeah. Like, it's a paperback book that you're buying. That's ridiculous.
They kind of still make it worth my while. And I'll tell you why. When I pick up an old PC Gamer Edge, I really enjoy picking up on the tonality and expectations of that time, as well as getting the brilliant minutiae of different the syntagmatic brilliance that these writers had for describing games artistically or the way in which they were compelled to.
You're gonna have to explain syntagmatic for me and for every single person listening.
It just means that your syntax usually it's something you use in deconstruction, but it could also be something you talk about in quality of writing or someone's speech, which is your syntax, or specifically the you're talking about like adjectives. Basically your synonyms can match up beautifully, but they match up in a preparatory way too. So your pronouns and like your ifs, your thes, as well as your uses of s's create a kind of alliteration. They flow better just in how you hear them. But the mechanic doesn't go any further than that, because as we know about language, we don't quite know why we appreciate certain sounds over other ones yet. But it's just that's sometimes called syntagmatic as opposed to paradigmatic, which is a whole other thing that we'll bring Krishna Srikumar, our favorite guest, in to talk about one day. He uses that term a lot.
But he's probably never played a video game.
But what I mean to say is reading these old... There are capsules of what the gaming industry was like at that time.
Mm.
You get to access them again. And more importantly, some of these writers were your favorite guys to read back through.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you have features like long plays are not timeless, but they could almost be something that you could look at as a timeless feature of a magazine. A long play is always going to mean something about that game and how that person experienced it, if he wrote it well, and if he dedicated himself to breaking down in an article format what that game was about.
Which brings us to, I suppose, the other, it's no longer the magazine era, but the publication that I suppose reignited my interest in video games, because there's a period between about age, let's say 19 to maybe 25 or something where I didn't really play video games. Maybe not 19, maybe 20. I don't know what age it was. I'm just making up numbers here. But there's several years. And reading One Up in college and watching the videos and game trailers and the One Up show really reignited my interest in video games, because not so much the content, but the passion that they brought to it. Oh, I can see your face now in the glorious light from your laptop.
In the loom of my laptop.
And there was a team at One Up, at One Up slash EGM, which was kind of the same company, especially towards the end, run by Ziff Davis Publications. There's a team there, people like Sean Elliott, who I'm always going on about, and Luke Smith, who's this amazing critical writer, and Shane Bettenhausen, who was sort of a Sony fanboy but also fantastically articulate. All of these people have now gone on to Garnet Lee. They all work in the video games industry producing games, with the exception of Garnet Lee, who never went anywhere. He's some flack for some.
And Jeremy Parrish moved on with him as well, and he was one of my favorite Jeremy writers Parrish. There. I came in right towards the end of One Up, the last 2 years.
So and there was a whole, all the guys who do Rebel FM now, Anthony Gallegos and Arthur Geese and Matt Chandran, and all those guys were also involved in it. And just such an amazing, it was like the final gasp of the industry. Somebody decided, what if we just throw loads of money at these kids and let them do whatever they want? And the sheer fun of the office environment, or at least the illusion of it that was conveyed in their videos, and the sheer authenticity of their opinions was just so fantastic. I think it's a real shame that it was castrated and then finally killed off. Which,
do you know what, the way you describe that reminds me of how much of that model that Dave Schneider and Jeff Gerstmann tried to kind of borrow and import into the Giant Bomb system, of always showing, like giving you these brief videos and glimpses into them opening up packages from fans, showing the office as they write up a new idea for a video feature and then just get rid of it there and then, them joking around with one another and playing multiplayer games on their iPhone, as well as doing quick looks and just bringing people in at random from other staff studios.
I get that that's why people like...
I find that their way of doing it doesn't have the same... I don't know, not that they're not as intelligent, but they're not the same kinds of people.
I think they're not diverse.
That's a way, but yes, absolutely.
And they don't, like, they're... Whenever I listen to Giant Blob, I always feel like they're doing like an impersonation of talk radio, talking really quick and kind of talk radio voices, which is feels really put on. I'm sure it's not, but it just doesn't. And the other thing is that they're talking to each other, and it is, like you said, it's very exclusive, it's very in-jokey.
Yeah, it's very esoteric. Yeah. The same way that a lot of actual talk radio does become very esoteric. Exactly. With its fans. Yeah. Same way, like, Opie and Anthony did become that.
Somebody who's been doing a show for years and years, whereas with One Up,
which I don't have necessarily a problem with either. Well, but it's different
with the One Up stuff and the EGM stuff. It's not that it wasn't it had its own culture, but there was so many people involved that there's a diversity to it, and subgroups within that who would do the different shows, One Up Yours or the One Up Show or whatever. They had a bunch of shows over the years, and they formed their own cliques that had totally different styles, and but the house style was this kind of openness and kindness. Actually, real kindness to each other, and attempting to be critical and to be very ethical. And they had all these, like, really strong ethical guidelines. And One Up was one of the first places to do that. Which, of course, you know, all the really good Let's Players do now, and Total Biscuit and Giant Bomb. But they really defined that. They were like, and Polygon have actually made it a kind of central tenet of their quote unquote journalism, is to be very ethical. And I don't know if they're actually managing it, because the wall between editorial and marketing has gone completely now, it, just in general in journalism, and Polygon are a really good example of that. Like, everything on Polygon is kind of advertorial.
Yeah, I did notice that, but I wasn't sure if that, because so much of the other, including Giant Bomb and GameSpot, who used to be, well, I know GameSpot anyway, was completely dominated by a marketing team and definitely people who worked above and had
IGN
direct manipulation
well.
Of the editorial staff. They've shifted so much of that now to have direct audience focus and to cut out as much of the marketing middlemen as possible. So it's odd that it's just odd that Polygon is doing that when someone else, so many other places are not, so many other publications do something separate.
Polygon was created, and there's a documentary about the creation of Polygon. It's created in this, like, Polygon is extremely expensive to produce. It's done, as far as I know, I think it's in Manhattan. Although a lot of it is people all around the country wirelessly, but they have a fuck off office. The Verge, Polygon, have a fuck off office in Manhattan, which is extremely expensive, huge office, and it's got, like, all the top media consultants in how to monetize new media were kind of brought together to, like, figure out a platform that would have all these ways to make money and stuff. So it's extremely well thought out, but it's highly a product of the moment. It's not journalism trying to modernize. It's the opposite. It's sort of online money trying to make an outlet.
Mm.
And all of the shininess is kind of conflicted with the other side of it, which is, well, we all often talk about how it's like incredibly politically correct to like painfully politically correct.
Yeah.
And it also is kind of dubious in terms of marketing. Like they do have lots of critical reviews and they've lots of articles that aren't paid for, but you always feel like you're not quite sure if this is influenced by this, and they all know each other, and there's the marketing guy is part of the editorial team and stuff. It makes me feel queasy reading.
Well, it's interesting because it means you have this kind of a pre-loaded or pre-cognizant almost mm-hmm. idea of dubiousness that lies underneath the writing of these pieces or these op-eds, when actually that same level of information isn't available to you for some of the greatest op-eds you read,
yeah.
where you don't know if the motivations are down below, that these people know each other, that they work for that game or have worked with friends of that game
and
company.
It's not their fault. Kotaku did that.
Mm.
Gawker Media made a game blog, Kotaku, which mm-hmm. is no longer game.
Game blog, like, which quickly became about living in Japan and things like that.
Bizarrely. Yeah. But they did that. They started this thing of publishing every press release because it gave them more content. And then so much stuff that was given to them by Flax, by PR people, who are, you know, the worst people in the world. If you've ever met a PR person, they're creepy and weird.
Yeah, super hot sometimes, though.
Yeah, but then you only think that because they're fake flirting with you because you're used to them for 2 seconds. I just hate that so.
I was used to them for at least 5 minutes, I'll have you know.
They're just creepy. They're the kind of person that would like marry someone, live with them for 8 years, have children with
and
them.
And have no feeling.
And, no, the whole thing was just a marketing exercise. So they could sell the brand to the... Oh, they're just creepy, weird people with no soul.
Mm. Yep, I agree.
Sorry, child of the 90s, like a... I still think Fight Club is a profound commentary on modern consumerism. Mm-hmm. So apologies.
Not on modern anarchism in any way, though.
No.
Which a lot of people say is about anarchism. It's actually in some ways a criticism of anarchism, too. So anyway, yes, back into the
It's just a gay love story, really. It's never consummated between a man and himself.
They should just get over it.
The ultimate mirror stage. They should get over it. They should break up.
The ultimate mirror stage. Wanting to fuck himself. It's brilliant. You never stop looking at the mirror. It's the problem.
So that was the first part of our... This has been recorded two years later. That was the first part of our grab bag. What was the second one? Oh, the role of the writer in games.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I wrote that in because we've had the piece of news this week. Do you want to fill us in on the writorial news?
You know what? I should. It's a yes and scenario, but I kind of think you should fill us in because you probably have both names more on hand than I do.
No, I don't at all.
Okay, so the lead narrative designer of Naughty Dog, as well as was it a motion capture expert or no, was someone on the technical side of developing?
Hairstyle.
Yes. So lead narrative designer has been there since 2004, who worked on both Uncharted games, I think the third one a bit as well, and was essentially one of the driving forces behind the writing of The Last of Us, mm-hmm. a fantastic game, has just moved over to Infinity Ward and Activision. So, or by going to Infinity Ward, now works under Activision. And this is also another employee, but I can't remember their name. I know one's Kaczynski, but the other one I can't remember.
Chig Moon Calf.
Yes, exactly.
Fred Flintstone.
Why even say Fred Flintstone?
I don't know.
That was such a waste of your time.
Just hoping if I said names, eventually I get the right one.
The right one. Like that joke in Father Ted.
Yeah. Moogly hoogly. Beginty schminty. But these are the kind of two of the core creative personnel behind The Last of Us,
mm-hmm.
which is the most critically acclaimed narrative game of recent years. And it brings up the question, you've had Amy Kohler, is that her name? The writer of Uncharted was... By all accounts, pushed out of Naughty Dog, and now you're getting the Last of Us guys gone. Is there such a thing as the author in a video game? You know, obviously indie video games, one person makes it, blah blah blah. But this seems like a big thing. This is the creative heart and soul have left the company within 1 year. They've lost all the main writers. Do writers matter to video games, or are video games such a big project that a writer's voice is less important?
Or at least with these scales of projects where you have almost like whole teams made up just to design the water and how it flows and level, how much control can you have over the flow and atmosphere of the game's environment and what it's telling you? Like Ken Levine talked about this, and a lot of this came out with the post-mortem on Bioshock Infinite after that company fell apart, or at least, sorry, voluntarily fell apart. And they were talking about how Ken Levine had to be the kind of person who was technically such a genius that he could delve into every aspect of its development so as to make sure that all of it was flowing with the same theme, the same kind of colour. I mean, I'm just bringing up adjectives here, but you know what I'm saying. This carrying forward his narrative and his plot.
Keeping
his
the flavour.
Yeah.
It's like you're cooking something and there's like 400 people cooking it.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that all the bits spoil the broth. The kitchen. Yeah, none of them are putting in like, I don't know, xylitol or something.
Yeah.
That's which is a particularly diuretic sugar substitute, which I unfortunately ate in cake.
Or lidocaine, because they enjoy it and they love numbing. I don't know. It's either way. It's a very difficult procedure. And I know that this discussion is relevant to Assassin's Creed and where that game went. Because after Brotherhood, the lead designer, narrative kind of focus of...
I didn't know
Assassin's Creed came from him.
Okay.
I can't remember. Not Marcel something. He was a French person.
But that is extremely... In retrospect, something had to have changed between that game and
between Brotherhood, and I know you like Revelations, but it was a sudden shift because all of a sudden Revelations was just the same game as before, but some additions, and something's not quite right because Revelations isn't really telling as much of a story as Brotherhood and Assassin's Creed 2 was. So and then you go to 3, something did change hugely.
Well, they dropped the storyline. For one thing, they sort of were like, oh yeah, all the meta narrative, we don't really give a shit about that. Like, it just completely, it's gone. It's gone.
Well, they've ended it in 3, actually.
Yeah. Like, no spoilers, but I know what happens in 3 despite the fact that I haven't played it. But they were like, well, yeah, we don't care about all this. We've dug a hole. It the Lost phenomenon. They were like, yeah, with Jesus did it or whatever.
I have debates against that, but yes, yeah, I know. It is almost like that concept that people have that is incorrect about Lost ending.
Sure.
Which is, yeah, well, I understand what you're getting
at. Well, there's a great TED talk from the very, when TED first became a big, and actually the first couple of years of TED are actually excellent. TED has got a reputation for being fluffy bullshit, which it now is.
Because it is fluffy bullshit.
Yeah,
now,
but the first couple of years of it, they sort of went through all of the geniuses that are doing cutting edge, brilliant stuff and also quite optimistic.
And then ran out.
And then now it's just all the marketing people. And
yeah, like Mark Moran's getting there with his show.
yeah, he probably will be on TED. I revolutionized podcasting. I knew what I could say.
I was number 1 and 2 on iTunes.
I've always been a genius and I just found a way to make other people realize what a genius they are.
And then he pulls out a stool and tries to do a comedy bit again.
But it's literally a stool, like it's a piece of shit. He just smears himself with it. Dirty protest.
Louis can get away with it. Why can't I?
This is art.
Yeah.
Ding. I've got a huge dung.
I really like him and what the fuck. Mike Myers, he's amazing.
I do like
that,
him. But Mike Myers interview recently.
Oh, yeah. The last one I listened to was, I listened to Mike Myers, but then afterwards I listened to the John Hamm one from season 3.
Oh,
it was fantastic.
It's good.
It's really, really good. Like the information he gets.
They
out
should
of
have
it.
Compared dungs. Two famous large
I
dungs.
Think he drops some form of truth serum in the drink before he talks to them because they give him information they never give anybody else. I don't know how
he just rubs that
up.
Big dung and they get so excited
and that Italian hog just frightens everybody.
People are like, who's Mark Maron?
No, they know Mark Maron. They have to know Mark Maron.
Yeah, that's true.
Because
you're listening to a
from
podcast.
His most famous of roles, the Red Squirrel in Adventure Time.
And I say people, but since we had a competition hidden at the end of the last episode that no one entered.
What are you talking about? I entered it at least 4 times.
We had a little cliffhanger. End of the last episode, we're like, does anyone listen this far in? Does anyone get the real deep cut? And we left a little competition. We left a little strip of delicious foreskin. And no one entered, so...
I should be sad about that, but I'm not. It's almost like I was never doing it for them anyway. I was kind of,
this is like a Waiting for Godot type situation.
It is, yeah. And he's never going to show up, as you know.
But you know what? You know what? I have this neurotic belief, and maybe it's because I'm so crazy I need to have these things to persist.
Sure.
But I have this belief, right, that we're at the... You're gonna think this is narcissistic. Right, and it is.
Everything you say, do you think I'm removing that?
So, well,
I'm narcissistic as well, it's fine. Well, I'm schizoid, but yeah, go on.
I think we're at the dawn of history, right? The beginning of the long history of the human race. We cross the stars, we prolong our lives to live thousands of years, we communicate mind to mind directly in an augmented universe of our own making, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's even slightly true, We're at the dawn of history because this is the first... There are people alive who weren't alive before we figured out how to store information in a way that could be passed on forever.
Mm-hmm.
So everything, right? Everything that we make at the start, this is all the paleo creation of culture. We are the earliest memory of a culture that might last a million years.
We are the starting digital amino acids. Is that right. What you're saying?
Yes.
In this LCL.
So every protein that we create, right, every gene we lay down will be in every animal from here on out. So when they go to look at the very beginnings, when the bearded gaseous professor who's
the floating gaseous purple, yeah, just like
with a monocle and a beard made of gas, when he's like writing a
when he's
writing a cyber paper for Internet Squared on the basic meta communication of video games, this is going to be like a course text. There are future cyborg students
right now, in a relativity sense,
in the endless moment of forever that is the present moment. Because of course Alan Watts is the god in the future, the great, he's the Muhammad of the future. This is core text. So basically everything we say is really important, and that is what I have to believe in order to do anything, get up in the morning.
But the codified ethics of this later future have actually been able to detect massive disgusting narcissism and puerile attempts to hide schizoid behavior and actually are looking at us as a case example of how horrifying humans can be with audio technology.
That's fine too.
Yeah, as long as I'm famous.
or it's just one of us has done a perfect gentleman.
Oh no.
It's 6 months from now, and 100 people are dead in Grafton Street. And we were searching for evidence in all he said. and Weeboos on 4chan.
And this
on
will be 4chan. My manifesto right here. Jesus.
Weeboos on 4chan are saving all this shit, pouring over it.
And everybody will do the confirmation bias of like, there's where he's sexist. There's where he hated children. There's where he's ageist. They'll just find every adjective that's negative.
They will.
And then... I'll be famous. So
I actually had an experience. This is like
it's good that you had one. Sorry, I don't know why that was so easy.
You dill hole. Well, so you know the negative version of my perfect future that I'm dreaming of is the more real one, which is that everyone's going to look at your tweets for your jobs. So I had an experience recently where I was supposed to interview someone at this festival thing that I was talking about, and they cancelled the interview. And they were really weird. And I think it's because they went on my Twitter and saw all my like pro-Palestinian stuff.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong. Maybe they
good for you.
Asked someone and discovered I wasn't famous or something. I don't know. But it was really odd. They were like, oh, suddenly we don't have time. And so I'm just thinking. But that's a paranoid thought. It's like when a girl doesn't turn up for a date, you're like, oh, it's because I have a hairy eye or something.
Well, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're not right or they're not after you, which is my addition of the right part. But look, the thing about that aspect of being paranoid, right?
Mm.
Which is to the point where you think someone has perceived some Twitter comments, is not out of time or you being out of place or cognizing on a level of paranoia that's just like unhealthy, or even if it's unhealthy, that comes from just you. I think that's very much a telling of the time you're in. I think that people are getting to that stage.
Right.
I was briefly in advertising, and I can tell you, not that I was an advertiser. I worked there barely there for 2 weeks, but I saw a lot of tech. I was given a full tour of the biggest media company in Ireland, Core Media. I can tell you that they have software, and everyone knows this already, that collates and collects and aggregates every single tweet or Facebook comment about a product or a particular adjective all into one place and gives you exact numbers and breakdowns and averages on the kinds of people making those comments, if they're positive or negative. The program itself will detect if it's positive or negative by checking the prefaces and actually seeing what the build up to that.
What if I call everything good bad from now on?
Exactly. Well, this is the thing. There are already people coming out with hilarious linguistic tricks to try and beat these systems. But it goes to show you that if the technology is there for advertisers, people who are just trying to collate you as just a number to play to in their game of please, please justify our existence in this horrible media planning way, then it's not unlikely that it will get to a point where, because all software dominantly in control of private hands becomes open software eventually. There's nothing stopping this being something that we do in future to decide who our employees are, to decide who our friends are.
I've just had a worse thought, right?
Okay.
Okay. We as a species are doomed, of course. Only the machine intelligence will survive.
But
the machine intelligence
get involved, and I will not be a great torque wearer. Golden torque right here.
The machine intelligences will become so powerful that they can edit history itself
through their
direct manipulation of time and space.
No.
So they will look back on what is worth preserving from the paleo history of this future society, and they will listen to everything at super speed. And right now, an algorithm is parsing every single thing we said and did. Not worth it.
Fuck.
Not only is it worthless, but we never existed at all.
That's depressing, man. You got to me right there. Because I know that algorithm would find any condition.
I got you in the feels. I got your feels.
My feels right here. My feels. Is this the chest area is my feels. It will probably. It's a chaos theory equation that gets rid of all that's useless before the end.
Oh my goodness.
It's us. We're gone. We're already
gone. We could have had immortality.
Talking. Let's stop. We're already done. It's over. It's done. Chaos theory.
Nothing to be done.
Yeah. My neophytic understanding of chaos theory tells me it's already over. Well, I'm glad we went on to those topics and I enjoyed them because it's the level of, this is filler episode of Threat Detection. Like I said, this is the kind of things we're going to discuss. So you added in another thing here, although we should probably expand a little bit more on that idea of what happens when a lead narrative designer leaves.
We never talked about it.
Well,
so what do you think happens? Because I don't know or care.
Really. No, I don't really care, no, either. But I do care insofar as the games we like. Like Assassin's Creed.
Absolutely. It's heartbreaking that franchise went from this such huge potential to whatever modern toss it is today.
Mm-hmm. But you've played them. I haven't even played the last one.
I played half of it. I finished all of the others.
Do you have this thing, and this is more of a question about age and consciousness, but it's relative to the games we're playing. Do you have this thing now where you're playing the game?
It's a bit hair on my
and
ass.
What you were? Okay. No. I never ask you those questions. You just volunteer them. Do you ever get to this place with games? It's with most mediums that we find entertaining, but particularly games.
Yeah.
Where you're now listening to the story segment, or you're watching the cutscene, and you're so done with it. As in, you know, because you've predicted the next couple of lines because you've heard these platitudes and these common paroxysms all the time. And you know the catchment of information that's going to come to set up this enemy who will have this technology which will loop back in. And it's not because you're a narratologist. You're not a brilliant studier of narrative. You just know it because you've played the same shit so many times. And the mechanics may be almost there. And some of the things may have refined the gameplay. But in the end, this story is so dull. And it's almost to the point of it's actually taking out your impassioned to finish the game. Like, you don't even want to... Because a game shouldn't entirely be based on its plot, but narrative and game design are so intertwined now for me in the best of games that I can't bear to sit through games anymore that just say things that I don't... So what I'm trying to say is, do you get that frustration now? I mean, you're quite a bit older than me, but I'm at that point now when I'm playing something...
Quite a bit.
Yeah, as a 26-year-old. Yeah, see, I saved you. Yeah. Do you play the game and you just hear them say the line, and the line could just be like, I can't believe that Jackson did that. It's like, we're gonna
call in for support.
Yeah, like, we're Oscar Mike again,
we're on our own,
we're Jerry Timmons, or what? They just say it and you know it, and it doesn't even matter if that you know the term. And I'm not giving any specific example because I think you know what I'm talking about. It's just that feeling when you hear the line, you think, I can't put up with this anymore. I'm actually so angry. And you're gonna say, well, that anger comes from somewhere else. No, I'm telling you, the anger is being generated by the game being that bad.
I think this is there's a lot of things going on there. One of them is that the best games have gotten so good now,
mm-hmm.
in every respect, including narrative, mm-hmm. that when you go back to an older game or you see a modern Call of Duty style narratively empty game, that you're just like, why did I ever tolerate that? The other thing is, yeah, as you get older, you like, I think that your native love for things becomes a nostalgic love for things. There's few primary stimuli and more conditioned stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really tragic thing, but it's like love. You know, people always look at teenagers and they go, oh, they don't know love. You know, our cultural myth, love is when you've been with someone for 100 years and you wipe.
At least it better be, because of the shit I've had to do.
they're no longer capable of doing anything but shitting, and you wipe the shit lovingly away. Like,
farting in the bed, yeah. Robin Williams.
Stuff. None of that's love. That's all grim, horrible. Love is when you're 13 or 14 and you're exploding from the heart out when you look at the person that is your crush, and when they say no, you die, and when they say yes, you ascend to you know. So through your life, you are capable of feeling less and less.
Yeah,
and
definitely,
you know, it takes more and more
intellectual guards that arise.
Oh, it's worse than that. Synaptic pruning.
Oh, you actually mentioned pruning. Okay, literally, fine. Let's go to the neurological.
Literally killed the parts of you that could feel.
That could actually express in such a large level. I would argue against some of that, because it's definitely proof that you can experience at higher pitches as the pruning process gets better. But that could go back down to your argument of conditionality. Some people have conditioned in that direction to experience at higher pitches, while others haven't. Because I would say the neoliberal world we talk about so often, probably for people like us, just prunes you towards this kind of base level of, look, if it's not making money, or it isn't making money, it's about the money. And I even had that discussion with previous employers of mine and a friend of mine today about, sure, if you have money, it'll save you here. If you have money, it'll save you here. Don't worry about that stuff until you have enough money. And everything he was saying was right. And that's what was depressing, because it shouldn't be right that I have to have a certain, because I make money. I'm saying, what he's saying is you should be making this much more to get to this next level.
Mm.
It's the argument of, you want to save poor people? Be rich to save the poor people. That thinking.
I'm thinking of the scene in, I don't know if it's Taken or if it's the...
I hope it's not Taken.
Or if it's that scene, that show where Claire Danes plays a manic depressive CIA agent.
Oh, yes, you're talking about Homeland.
Homeland. There's a great scene, I think it's in Homeland, there's a great scene where the Sheikh brings in a woman to be auditioned for his harem, and he stands, he doesn't say anything, and he has another beautiful woman interviewing her, and she's, you know, and are you hairless down there, because the Sheikh does not tolerate any hair. And of course. And do you like girls? Oh, sure. And anal? Oh, yes, of course. And the Sheikh is just totally emotionless.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember how we got onto that.
Yeah.
But I just thought...
Wasn't that funny?
I just thought I'd mention it.
Yeah.
What were we talking about?
I don't know. I don't even know. You're making me think of these massive guys now. You're making me think of like these... Oh, what are they called again?
Jadedness. That's why. Yeah. That's what I was...
Yeah.
This is about... Yeah, we are jaded because of the surfeit of plenty. There's a great story from my Beckett weekend that...
Surfeit of plenty. Please.
Beckett came to Ireland after the war. He had lived, you know, in France, which was very deprived during World War II. Mm-hmm. We imagine them with delicious baguettes and the resistance and hello, hello. No, it was quite grim.
It depends on the section you're in or who you were. But
sure.
Yeah,
if you were some kind of Vichy bloated Baron Harkonnen, you're fine.
But... Oh, please. They weren't all resistant members. They were all massive collaborators and they know it.
Well, he won a couple of medals. But he came to Ireland and someone offered him high tea. You know, he was this literary figure. He was doing well. Here's high tea. You're fantastic. And he was like, no, I can't. I can't eat it. Oh, why, Beckett? Have some. You'll be famous in the future and earn lots of money for Ireland.com. And he said, my friends are eating sawdust. I can't touch the food, you know. And look, that's a stupid story. But the point is that we do have so much now. We are constantly, oh my goodness, my creamed rice isn't exactly as delicious as the creamed rice I had in the other restaurant yesterday.
Well,
it wasn't. But there's a hedonic plateau, the term in psychology, hedonic plateau.
Yeah, I know.
You constantly get used to higher and higher levels of service and deliciousness. Yeah. And the same is true of narrative. You know, I used to read these...
Also, just to point out, there's no normative. Some people think about hedonic plateaus and they think, well, if you take certain things away, there's a return to normative. There's no normative. It's even worse. You actually return to a worser state than you were before if you take away the pleasure.
You can never enjoy the whole thing.
That's the thing. It's actually proven with rats. You take away the pleasure or the stimuli that was giving them the pleasure. They don't return to a natural or whatever... there was no equilibrium of a neurotransmitter state. Or neuromodulator state. It's even worse. They get more depressed.
Why didn't we call this show It's Proven with Rats?
Because
that's so much better.
Because we're frightened of attachments to the Jewish people. That's why.
Oh my god.
Yep.
Okay,
I said it, Gareth.
Take it back.
That was my full stop.
Apologies.
I'm so sorry.
On behalf of...
I apologize.
I'm a huge fan of Jewish culture. And I did see Beckett in Yiddish and it was magnificent.
Yeah, you were telling me. You were saying that, yeah. Which I find quite odd, again.
It was far better than in Godot in Yiddish. It's just far better than English. Apparently it's very excellent in French also. They were also showing it in French, but I didn't know if I could take two Godots in one day. I actually regret not. If you ever get the chance to take two Godots in one day, take two. It's really good for an upset tummy. Take two. What's next? Okay, the revival of classic games. Remake, remaster. Giant Citizen Kabuto has been re-released, not remastered or remade, but re-released with new patches by good old games.
Yeah.
Great game, looks terrible now. Oh, the tragedy. Total Biscuit liked it, but he liked it for money, so that's...
Yeah.
Guy's dying. We can't really criticize him.
Can we not? Is he dying? I didn't know that.
He has a very serious cancer, which I believe has metastasized.
That's terrible. Is it in the lungs?
I think it's worse than that. I think it's actually in the... it's in the bottom.
In his ass?
This is fucked up, dude. We're playing this...
You said
we're playing this for comedy.
Questions.
I don't... Stop making me play it for comedy.
I'm not making you play for comedy. You said it's in his bottom.
He has ass cancer.
Oh, Jesus.
For real.
Okay, all right, fine. He has ass cancer. Look, I'm just going to say this. I don't know Total Biscuit. I never watched the stuff. I never really liked the stuff I did see.
Oh, will you? Now you're going to say, this is the moment you choose to say you don't like his stuff.
That's because I'm so universal in my judgment. Dying or alive.
Well, I never liked Giant Blob before he died of sleep apnea. And I have sleep apnea.
He didn't die of sleep apnea.
He did.
Because of his heart condition, which came about because of the sleep apnea. Of course, sorry, I forgot. Apologies, Gareth, for insulting the condition that you suffered.
What was his name again?
Ryan Davis.
Ryan Davis. Ryan Davis.
No, he was brilliant. No, he was very interesting.
R.I.P.
Yeah, absolutely. But you don't have to like him because I like him. I would never actually
I have to like him because he's dead.
No, I don't think you do. It's a terrible.
This is the
it.
Moment the algorithm decides you are not worthy of reviving. And it could bring us back to life, fully regenerate us based on these recordings.
Yeah, like the Inquisitor from Red Dwarf, we'll come back alive, rematerialize, just to be judged by ourselves. And then we'll die again. See, they'll bring us back just to murder us.
Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, they are alive in this heaven future where the computer consciousnesses have decided who deserves it.
Yeah.
For an eternity. Mm-hmm. Beyond the heat death of the universe. Forever. Infinite pleasure. Never gets dull. Yeah. Always variegated.
Yeah. Like that Japanese series Kaiba where memories are just floating in space and you can put them in a data chip and put it in your head and switch bodies and whatever. That's actually what happens. This is not the place to call anybody out for being a nerd. That's just like...
I just wanted to sing the nerd song.
It's like being in some sort of like rape clinic and like taking a judgment on someone. Like, I should say a rehab clinic for rapists.
Rape clinic?
I don't even know what
to
call it.
This is how you do it, folks.
I just like the idea that you would make a judgment there. It's like, well, that's a bit too much for me. I was going to mention that for redevelopment stuff, Jagged Alliance came back out. And I was a big fan of Jagged Alliance from Mad Lab Software, which is kind of a spin on the Fallout idea of an isometric top-down turn-based game. We're using those tactical abilities where you'd like up your perks and you up your ability to, you know, you build skills towards a kind of Dungeons & Dragons system, but not quite, where you can shoot that guy in the head or get... you. Pick the place to shoot them, and the percentage is based on how your accuracy is, what your distance is, what kind of land you're on. Really, 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 really tactical game, but very cool because you choose mercenaries to take into this often, you know, you choose it Yugoslavia-like or, you know, Belgian Congo-like island setting or Eastern European setting, which is the first two games. And you enter into this politically difficult situation where there's divided terrorist cell units, and you enter as mercenaries trying to either help the region or help in its destruction or help in its regrowth. And what you do is you choose those guys and you have a certain amount of money to pay the mercenaries, much like Blackwater or some mass mercenary group, but you don't necessarily have enough money at the start to buy the best of guys, so you buy the worst of them. They'll have random dialogue, or semi-random dialogue because it is written. They'll have dialogue that generates based on who's with who. They might not like each other, which means they'll do terrible together. They might like each other, which means they'll do even better together. If they work well together, it means they shoot better, they have more confidence. They'll do random things like give each other ammo when you won't tell them to. There's loads of really, really cool stuff that came out of the Jagged Alliance games that you now see kind of in more, like you'd see now in, I suppose, Fallout New Vegas, stuff that's kind of borrowed a lot from these more tactically immersive games.
So they
HD-ified it. They took the first one and I think the second one now as well, and they made it real time as well. Mm-hmm. So instead of allowing for the tactical Fallout system where, you know, his turn, my turn, certain amount of action points, you know, see, like a lot of action points to shoot, not so many to move, you know, that kind of thing, and you have to think about where you move them. They made it real time, so you just keep moving and shooting, which kind of actually breaks a lot of it. But yeah, they HDified those, not necessarily to a good effect. Baldur's Gate, same thing. Baldur's Gate 1 and now 2 is getting a HDified moment.
There was some issue with those games. I remember that where they were, either they screwed up the balance or they weren't playable, and there was some really major gripe.
Yeah, well, there would be, because the people who are actually doing these conversions, which is, you know, it goes on to another topic we'll talk about one day, which is porting and things like that, are doing kind of an awful job. Mm. So they're either regenerating assets that were never meant to be above 640 by 480 into like 1080p and completely blurring them or slashing them or causing cuts in the maps, or they're creating whole new assets that don't fall into the actual design or the aesthetic of the original games. So you're having and you're also having clashes with the coding, because these games are based around a very specific engine that you never see anymore. You know, it's like people trying to remake Scum games but without the Scum engine, and it just won't work because there's a very particular design that went into that no one even thinks about now, because your games back then, the kinds of engines you built, these very linear, let's call them modalities of games, whether it be tactical, isometric, or, you know, side-scrolling adventure games, were so specific to what you could do in them, almost hard-coded. No one thinks like that anymore in coding. Yeah. Games are much more open-ended in their engines.
This is kind of like David Byrne's argument in how music works, is his book on the music industry and music and theory of music, and he talks about how a venue or an instrument or, you know, even a monetary system, all these things create the art that functions within those mechanics. You know, like for example, CBGB's in New York, where the new wave scene hit in the 1980s, early 1980s, including Talking Heads and many other bands of that ilk. Had a very specific sonic sound space, and it encourages a certain kind of music, simple and loud, you know, repetitive rather than melodic. And it was a very poor space in which to play highly melodic music, because the melody got lost in the space. And he talks about that in terms of concert halls and all the rest of it. But with something like the Scum Engine, you know, perhaps there is something about the way in which that is coded that encourages this kind of programming / writing methodology which gave rise to the voice of those games, to
absolutely.
Some extent.
And it brought up the voice and the aesthetic and the thinking behind those mechanics, but the actual, you know, defined way in which it works won't necessarily ever get recreated because it was so specific to one or two brains who then dominated a whole company that then wrapped itself around them, or never got documented correctly, and the few hands it stayed within never cared enough to regenerate it, that it just stays in its time frame. So regenerating it now with new assets, you're encountering all these issues between generations of developers. So like one generation of coders just thinks completely differently to the lateral way in which those who the predecessors did in the 90s. So it's a forerunner issue. It's the dilemma of a forerunner may have defined a lot of the again, modality and the schema of what you're in today. But that doesn't mean to say that you can literally rebuild in the same way they built it the first time. You're trapped in the framework of it, but you're not necessarily aware of what the foundations are. You can't see you can't see the structure, but you know you're in it, kind of thing.
So there's one way around this, which is to get the original team to remake or remaster the game, which is what's happening with Grim Fandango.
Yes,
which is
a brilliant
idea. I'm so excited
idea.
For that. Which is, Grim Fandango has got to be one of my all-time favorite games.
Yeah, mine too.
And it's one of those games where I replayed it a couple of years ago, and while it has major
control issues,
puzzle issues, and so on, the writing, the acting, and even the art hold up better than any game I can think of.
Superb. It's wonderful. It's
amazing. It's amazing.
In fact, the art in that, you will note, takes a lot of standardization approaches of how they do motion capture in the background, or specifically pre-rendered scenes cut in with like really jaggedy polygonal stuff. It's very similar to how Final Fantasy VII was built as well. If you actually go back and look at the Final Fantasy VII scenes where there's intense motion in pre-rendered backgrounds, so like pre-drawn art, mixed in with the generated art in the engine, the way in which they make the mesh, it's very similar to how they did it in Grim Fandango. So they have very, like, you can see that 1995 to 1998 jumps. You can also see those lines of 3D game art and development. And some of those games, because of that way of being drawn, kind of almost makes them timeless. Kind of. Mm-hmm. You look at Resident Evil, it's not quite the same. Resident Evil, you can kind of see that, hey, someone's just tricked my perspective. It's all one big square, and you've drawn walls, but they're not walls.
Well, this is like the switch from silent movies to talking movies. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone thinks it's this great development, but actually, the switch to talking movies, for 20 years, it's set movies back, 30 years.
Oh, yeah, reduced a huge amount of production.
Because they couldn't move the camera in any of the same ways. They couldn't do location recording. Mm-hmm. It became much more about a stage production on film rather than this incredibly adventurous thing that many of the silent movies were. And if you look at something like Wing Commander, the first Wing Commander, which is this pixel art, beautiful game, and the art now, today, it looks gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Wing Commander 2 or 3, where they introduced the FMVs and 3D graphics. Or like you said, Resident Evil, this proto 3D era, it's vomit-inducing.
It's
ugly.
Horrible.
The textures are terrible. There's about three polygons for someone's face. It just doesn't work.
It's the early stages of man. It's that horrible fetus thing where it's growing a tail and it's just like coiling itself. It's not quite a woman or a man yet. I don't want to see it at that stage. You don't want to see
your transphobia is getting worse with every episode.
I know, but it helps with games, right?
You got to take off that National Front t-shirt or I'm not continuing the episode.
Okay, fine.
In all seriousness, I unfriended someone on Facebook today because he was posting, what's that crazy UKIP party? Yeah, he was posting stuff. He was like, good to see the lads doing well. The local. I was like, you psycho, unfriended mentalist.
Yeah.
We joke. Listener. We joke non-existent listener.
We jape
about things that are no longer permissible to joke about because fuck that. But we don't actually, you know, we don't belong to some kind of regressive hate party of man troglodytes.
Yeah.
And there are people who do. And then you see that and it's like, oh, you actually think that? Oh, I'm kind of scared of you now.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to go away.
It makes you question as well the kind of, not trickery, but the veil of deception that you can see in the initial conveyed niceties that they threw towards you in the mores. And then the core, when you see this exclamation, or again, paroxysm in this big, like, exclamated remark of, like, you know, fuck this bunch of people. They think they have this right to say this. And you think, Jesus, the core of you is so different than what I ever could suspect.
You're
and
a bag of slushy hate.
Yeah, but it's like, I understand being a bag of hate, but this is different. This is where their core identity is corrupted in some way. Or no, but only on my value system. I'm not suggesting that they have, I've transcended whatever their complex is, or that I'm above them. It's just, when you see that, you think, Jesus, there are serious differences in humankind that we hide all the time. We're hiding them all of the time.
Or
we overlook them.
A sort of affiliation.
Mm.
You know, people have always shagged and hung out with people who were just like them. And now we can see just exactly how much you are like me with all your Facebook likes and tweets and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Which means we behave in ever more conformist fashions and only confirm our biases.
I'm just going to get the great torques around them, you know? Make sure we're the ones controlling them. That's all I'm saying.
Well, this is great. Finally, read these. Yeah. So there's a great book, series of sci-fi books that I like. It took years. James is finally reading them. Now he can't stop dropping the references as though anyone...
Left, right and center.
No one has read those books in 15 years other than me and you and
that,
one other person.
It's that singular individualist thing of if I know it, I assume everyone else knows it.
You are a narcissist after all. If you do like science fiction, do please go out and read the Galactic Milieu series by Julian May. Available in any good secondhand bookstore.
Yeah, well, this topic, anyway, what we started on, actually goes into something else. But I'm not actually, it's the same topic, which was talking about mechanical excess, which is a point I wrote down for our filler episode, which is that games today have so many more mechanics in them and what they allow you to do in 3D, you know, large scale, beautiful settings. That it's hard to go back to play games where mechanics weren't as pervasive. So what you could do was very, very restricted or reduced in that time because games had yet to access these areas of animation or access these areas of incredible verticality in level design so that you couldn't have that sense of growth and freedom and jumping or even just like a crisis and how you move in that compared to something like a first-person shooter like Quake where looking up was a struggle. And you go back now, and as much as we talk about this with conditionality of nostalgia over, you know, the actual fact of what you're seeing, there is this problem where some games can be timeless because of their art, but actually mechanically speaking, they're completely fucked. You go back and you play them and they're terrible. And Resident Evil is a game I can still play because I actually quite like that gameplay loop. The loop is quite satisfying. But there's no denying that what it did was it borrowed from a generation of Nintendo games, which was the itemization, build up, upgrade your items, have more access to one overall area that's semi-open world, growth out, fight bosses or alternatively don't fight bosses, one end boss that always is the same, one ending that's always the same. See what I'm saying? So your character is restricted in what he can do. They get slightly better with items and unlocks and dungeon settings, and they build towards the top. And it's very much what Resident Evil was. I mean, it was based on Sweet Home, which was a Japanese game on their version of the NES, which is, I can't remember what it was called again. What was their thing called again?
The Famicom.
Famicom, yeah. But there's no getting around it. They know that the...
Is that Family Computer? Is that where that comes from? Famicom?
I think so.
That just occurred to me.
Yeah.
Famicom,
yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that game has... You struggle to play it now if you're not really into it. I'm really into it because it's something I appreciate about it, but I had to be there and enjoy it. I don't think anybody now...
Couldn't come back to it without
not
having
played it. Not at all.
There's a common thing where people say in articles and stuff, you know, video games are like movies before they had invented, you know, the camera that was consistent, you know, before they had standardized film or whatever. And what I just realized when you're talking right there is that...
is that I hate everything that you're saying. No, I want to leave.
Is that that I pooed my pants. is that actually what makes video games different and what makes them in some ways the final platform or whatever bullshit term people use is that... We're never going to invent the camera. There will always be a new camera. Every new generation of game, every new iteration of development of what video games are, is about reinventing the camera.
Mm.
And that means that while we'll always be able to go back and enjoy things in a nostalgic or ironic or historical way, we're always going to be enraptured by the greater freedom that the new control scheme or the new three-dimensional perspective or the new enhanced graphics or the new AI. I mean, right now, I mean, we can imagine so many ways. If there was a game, same as every other game, except the AI could understand your language naturally. Oh my God. How different would that be? Could you go back to playing a game that couldn't do that? You know, there's so many ways you could immediately obsolete all games that we play now. Like a physical interface where you could trespass or like interface with every object, pick it up, move it around. But it worked.
It's the fear of redundancy that comes around that was in film, but kind of film transcended that with fantastic auteur artists who were able to define a style that can't really be recreated, or a moment that came so specifically with the filming, engineering and techniques that we can't see it again. But with games, it's because it's so interactive and based around the way you move and play, and that's so much part of what makes you immerse.
Move and play.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I actually don't know what you're talking about. But
it's not a reference. I'm just making up a song.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's well good. That's really good. I thought you were singing.
I want you, when I do that, I want you to go, oh.
No. No. This is after and before podcast talk, not the actual, yeah. But
either, okay, if you could just place your booty right here.
Yeah. They don't have to know about that. The mechanics of the game mean that that's a huge aspect of, and this is what talking about cameras as
a
well.
A huge ass.
Yeah, a huge ass. Aspect.
Hey, respect for that huge ass. We've come to an hour in. This is why I'm derailing, because the train is heading towards the canyon of time. And we are but the engine of futility carrying the passengers of boredom.
Uh-huh. You watched way too much Beckett. That's your problem right there. I'm waiting for God. It was not about timelessness, by the way. People keep getting
I never said it was about timelessness.
Some people think it's about that. It's about a kind of existential message of timelessness. It's not at all. It's about the relationship, and that just happens to be a background of why they're stuck together.
It's about this unconsummated homoerotic relationship between Holocaust survivors. no, really. Yeah, okay. Catastrophe, on the other hand.
Yeah.
That, in some ways, is about timelessness.
Yes. Well, I think it's much like with Marguerite Duras, it's their tragedy makes them live in this timeless scape of post-apocalyptia that they've chosen to be in because they can't forget the pattern or the moment itself. Because even though they can't ever recreate the moment, they're trying to, and they don't know why, and it's being stuck in those two different paradoxical states, which is like, you know, you read Moderato Cantabile or anything from Marguerite Duras, who's always dealing with her husband's, she's very autobiographical, she's dealing with her husband's crisis of World War II and how she came out of it with France, and seeing the different paradoxes that the government were saying with the resistentialist myth and De Gaulle, and how she was actually seeing the reality, which is no, we're invading these African countries and it's not right, and just dealing with all of this confluence, or not confluence I should say, this anti-confluence of people just living in this state of madness because they're all repressing the one truth, which is that they were kind of becoming the Nazis, and they in many ways were associated with the Nazis. It creates this interesting narrative field where what you're doing is you're talking around these problems because you don't know, you've yet to develop a language to discuss the state you're in. Well, now, I'm not saying Wait for God, I was about that. I'm just saying that landscape of the graveyard is in itself a statement about something.
It reminds me of by the way, that was an excellent intellectual kicking sand in my eyes. But
was it?
You so overwhelmed me with your knowledge of this ersatz philosophical plateau.
Well, thanks.
but there's a great anecdote from Vaclav Havel, which is
amazing man.
He sees a sign in a shopkeeper's window, and the sign says, "Rise up, proletariat workers of the world, unite!" Mm-hmm. And he realizes that the shopkeeper doesn't mean it. He put up the sign. The government doesn't want him to believe it.
Yeah, I remember this.
So the whole purpose of the sign is collusion. And at that moment, he realized that once we stop colluding, that they lose all power over us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before anyone goes away, I'd recommend watching the Left Bank film La Comme Lucienne. Also about the same concept, is about being continuous. Well, it's not quite this film touches upon it, but there's other films that from the same director and Alan Resnais as well, which is about being tortured, literally being tortured by these people for this information that they want out of you. But it's not really about information, it's about complicity to this idea and to this system, and by resisting it all the way through, he gains a kind of freedom of the consciousness and of himself as an individual, and the idea of individual grows into something real because he resists a system that forces him to he has information they want, but he was a passive member of that information. He never wanted to have it, he just ended up with it, and now he's been tortured for it, and he refuses to acknowledge a system that believes torturing for information is right, so he can't give up
the power of the powerless.
Yes, absolutely. Which is to be silent and to make your own decisions regardless of what the alert noise or the screaming of the symbol is saying. So
does he at the end of the film become Sayyid Qatib and start the Islamic Revolution?
Actually, Lucien himself becomes super evil at the end of the film, but
is brilliant. This is clearly an allegory for the Islamic Revolution
in some ways.
Like directly what happened. Nasser in Egypt tortures Sayyid Qatib and all of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they create all of modern terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also a hegemonic state like America consistently dissolving all of the Middle East in favor of one country that it no longer supports. So, yeah, it's complicated. Politics, our other great podcast. But for now...
Right, and on that note of utter pretentiousness and completely off-topicness.
But also people are going to love us now, right? We're going to get like 40 comments on it and stuff, like our friend.
If the great algorithm has made it this far, perhaps we're worth saving after all.
We're going to have to write science fiction about this algorithm, by the way. It's really good stuff.
I think it's been done.
Oh,
it's
shit.
Done many, many times. The great editor. Mm-hmm. All right. Good night. Thank you. Good evening.
Bye-bye,
good night.
Guys.
And we love groupies. Please feel free to throw your groupie love.
Validate me.